The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy
with Nissan
on News Talk.
Now, you might have seen this story today or heard it in the news headlines, a sharp increase in the number of young adults who say they are suffering in terms of their mental health. This particularly true post-COVID. About 40% of young men and over half, 55% of young women, now classify themselves as depressed. This is according to research carried out by the ESRI. The ESRI is Eimear Smith. She was on Breakfast Briefing with Shane Beattie this morning and explained her concern around these figures.
We had expected that given the level of disruption to young adults' employment, education and social activities that we would see an increase, but the scale of the increase is very concerning, especially, you know, given there were already waiting lists for mental health supports and services prior to the pandemic.
That was Eimear Smith speaking, Eimear Smith of the ESRI speaking to Shane Beattie this morning. Anne Keogh is with us now, clinical psychologist and president-elect of the Psychological Society of Ireland. Anne, you're welcome to the show. I'm conscious of the timing of when this research was carried out, because I think it is important in understanding some of the figures and some of the factors Eimear is talking about. It was carried out in December 2020, when we were tearing ourselves apart here about what Christmas was going to look like, whether Christmas should be cancelled and moved to February, as some people were suggesting, others saying we should thumb our nose to COVID and just get on with it. It wasn't an easy time for anyone.
No, I remember it well. You're right. And I think it probably is a fair measure of where people were at that time. I don't think anyone will ever forget those Christmases through COVID, to be honest. They were really difficult times and people's mood was particularly low and continues to be at times across the country.
And how much then should we take that into account when we're trying to interpret these figures and these results and we ask ourselves what we can do to help?
Yeah, no, they're actually quite important figures in thinking about what we're recovering from, if you like, as a country. So some people, when they were kind of let back to in-person education, all the things that they would have liked to do, their jobs or their relationships or friends, you know, young people, events, all the rest of it, their mood improved massively. But many others hasn't. So some people are suffering the long and lasting effects of that, I suppose, deprivation in that time. And then, as you say, and as was said earlier, that the waiting lists are so long. Mm. It's a real issue because we're telling people to come forward and then telling them that, you know, the wait list is really long. And even though you've come forward for that help, it may not be available to you as you would like when you want it. So it's really challenging.
This is kind of a self-reported survey and depression is the description used in the headlines. But when we talk about depression in this context, we're talking about a real spectrum here, really, as well. And I think that's important to talk about, too, isn't it? That there's people with really acute problems. There's other people who maybe, you know, might have self-reported depression in the moment. But as you say, you know, as restrictions have lifted and as life has bounced back, they have been able to bounce back.
Exactly. So like when you think about depression, there are many different levels. Most people at some time in their lives will have felt very low or down, and at times you could classify that as mild depression, but then moderate depression would be more significant, and severe depression then is really significant. And how we judge that, I suppose, and how you tell if you really need help outside with that would be to think about how much that is getting in the way of living a normal and happy life. So can you enjoy the things you used to enjoy? Is your sleep or appetite affected? Are you tearful? You know, are you detached or feeling hopeless or helpless? Do you have suicidal thoughts or, you know, anxious or worried all the time? You know, that's really where you're getting a measure of how much it's impacting someone's life, how down they feel.
And is there kind of a domino effect, I wonder, when we're faced as a society with something kind of extraordinary like COVID, that, you know, people who might not have any other issues in normal circumstances, you know, might report mild symptoms, and the people maybe with mild symptoms, they kind of get bumped up to moderate to severe, that type of thing.
Yeah, well, I suppose if you take away people's coping strategies, so your coping strategy could be all the things that would have come with being out and being social and being connected in life. And people were afraid for their lives in that time. Most people, so they've really come through something traumatic, and then, you know, give people back their lives, some can bounce back, but lots don't. Lots are really sort of traumatized, or it's triggered a major, maybe a bigger episode of depression, where they're really struggling, you know, to have a normal life.
And then when we look at again, and you touched on this, and I kind of want to talk about it a bit more, the compounding of the waiting list problem, you know, can maybe give us a sense of like pre-COVID, just how bad that was for somebody presenting and wanting to access services.
So it depends a lot on who's presenting and on what level they're presenting and on what level of support. So there are lots of different supports. It could be talking to your GP. It could be talking to one of the charities like Aware or going to a support group. It could be then stepped up to needing to go to primary care level to seeing a psychologist or some supports at that level. Or it could be to going to adult mental health. So in secondary care, or following that, it could be inpatient in a hospital, depending on your level of depression. So, and it's not the same across the country. So the resourcing varies from place to place. So how long someone can wait can vary depending on the significance of their depressive episode, the kind of intervention they need. But I suppose people aren't always aware of that until they need it. And then there is this sort of expectation that, you know, things will be there when you need them. And then they are there, but you may have to wait longer than anybody would ever like. So sometimes it's a long, you know, number of weeks, months, up to over a year or two. In some places, it can be really a long time, which is unacceptable, wholly unacceptable.
I assume the danger in that year is that things get worse and the problem you're trying, somebody has kind of, you know, a pain in their knee or whatever it happens to be, you leave it untreated for the year, and then the pain you have to treat 12 months on is much more severe, the problem much more severe.
Yeah, well, in the case of something like depression, if you think about what happens for a person and how much that the symptoms of that will take them out of their lives. So they may be withdrawn from family and friends. They may be having significant relationship problems. I mean, that's standard if you're that down, if you're irritable or intolerant, you know, just difficult to get along with, that's going to happen. And then people are maybe not performing in work, or that's really impacted by that. So like time certainly compounds how people, like the level of kind of what you have to face. And it's not a good idea to have to wait for supports in that situation at all.
But people have to. I mean, they truly do.
And I think that's where a lot of the time the other supports come in, like family and friends. And sometimes they're like wonderful, but sometimes they're not equipped and they don't really know what to say to somebody. They can be really secretly worried about them and not want to show them how worried they are. They could just keep, like, oftentimes I meet people and, you know, their family are just asking, are you okay, over and over? Because they don't really know how to not want to fix it. You know, you just want to think, like, if I could do anything for them, I would. But it's not that simple with something like depression. So one of the things piece of advice I would say to kind of family, anyone who knows someone or is supporting someone, would be ask the person themselves, what, like, how are things for them? And then hold yourself back and just make lots of room to literally listen and hear what they have to say, not jump in or sort of make an assumption or even talk about the time you felt down. Just give them room, because they probably haven't had that. It's hard to do that because we want to make it better. Like, that's the natural human instinct for with a friend, a partner or a child, is to fix things. But it's not that simple. You know, if it was as simple as go for a walk or do this or do that, they would have done that already. So I think they, like, the helper, the person who's supporting, needs to really be conscious to make room. And then you don't have to have the solution. So the person who is quite down may have like a small idea they'd like you to do, or something really simple. Sometimes it's very practical things. You know, don't ask me, am I okay all the time? Or, you know, don't make a fuss, or please just do my washing. You know, like, it doesn't have to be grand gestures that we think will solve things. It's much more of a slow process where you listen to someone in the tiny minutiae they can come up with that says, what makes this day easier? Or what makes that next thing you have to do easier? And then sort of drawing them along back into their lives, really, and back into kind of, you know, achieving things or feeling connected or all those little things that people need.
And what about, putting in place the coping mechanisms before it gets to this point? And listen, some more severe levels of depression, I don't want to use the word unavoidable, but you know what I mean? There might be more going on than just kind of teaching a little bit of resilience. I'm talking maybe more, and because I'm conscious here of maybe sounding dismissive of people with kind of acute depression, and that they're somehow kind of a bit weak-willed. That is not the impression I want to give at all. But maybe at the kind of the milder end, and listen, I'm guilty of this. I'm raising two kids and I am brutal when it comes to equipping them with resilience, I have to say. But I don't think I'm alone in that. I think I'm kind of maybe par for the course of a certain generation.
Yeah, I think things have moved. It's a really tricky word, resilience, because if you, I agree with being really sensitive around that, because it implies that people should muster something from within to just get on with it. And that's really not what that means. Resilience is something like when you've come through something really challenging and you have learned ways to cope. If you are faced with that challenge again, you may have some ideas around how to cope with that. That's really what it means. So you can translate that right back down to little kids, like you're talking about your own, whereby if we as parents in the modern times, this is kind of unrelated to anything but depression, but if we do swoop in to fix a lot of things a lot of the time, kids don't have to work out what the difficulty might be or how they might solve it. So that's teaching them, you know, low level resilience on kind of challenging everyday tasks. So it doesn't really translate to someone with depression, because it's not that they don't have the coping strategies to tackle something. It's that their, literally their neurochemistry is not letting them do that. So one of the tasks, I suppose, in therapy or in working with people with depression is to really gently scaffold the idea. You know, if you have a huge task to do, sometimes maybe say clean your room or tackle a thing you've been avoiding, it seems unachievable, but you're going to scaffold little bits of that. So breaking it down and making it really doable. So, but it's a tricky word. I think we have to be careful with it, because it implies that you should just muster some random resilience from somewhere and get over it, is how it can sound. And people really want others to be well. I think it's really important to think about how, where that comes from. You know, when you sit with someone with depression, you say, oh, you know, come on, do this, do that. That's because you want them to be well. It's not because you don't, like, you know, it's not that you're trying to be mean from anything. It's more that you hope they are well. But we must be more realistic with them. It has to come from the person themselves, what they need, rather than telling them what to do.
Well, one listener here says, Kieran, my son has just turned 19. Those 2 years of COVID for him where I can tell the worst time in his life that he's experienced. I can totally appreciate those figures that were quoted by the ESRI. Well, thank you for that text. 5316, the number. And thank you to Ankyo, clinical psychologist, president-elect of the Psychological Society of Ireland. Stay with us here on the Heart Shoulder. I mentioned Dermot Bannon. He's going to be joining me in a few minutes' time with some home renovation advice. But after the break, Danny McConnell of the Irish Examiner looks into the political crystal ball.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy
with Nissan.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.